Welcome to This Is Money podcast in partnership with NS&I, your weekly roundup of the top personal finance, consumer and business stories that editor Simon Lambert and his team have been covering on their award-winning website. I'm your host, Georgie Frost. Alongside Simon Knight is consumer affairs editor Lee Boyce. And this week, finally, Simon Lambert, editor of one of the most widely read financial publications in the UK, has, as he's promised to do for many a year, as regular listeners will know, written his will. What took him so long? What did he learn? And why is it seemingly so low down the nation's priority list? Also today, we take a peek at the state of the nation's economy, ask how to prepare our finances for a possible rate rise, and look at if there is a lot more that banks could do to help victims of fraud. Plus, we ask what on earth is buffetology, bring you some good news for BT landline customers, and we get out our little diesel-powered violins and look at the cars we are most keen to scrap. All that and plenty more coming up. Don't forget you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, giving you 100% security for your savings, backed by HM Treasury.
Now, it should be pretty straightforward. As we delicately covered on last week's show when discussing inheritance tax, we are all going to die. There is nothing that we can do about that. But there are things that we can do to make sure that everything we leave behind goes to those that you want it to. And I'm not just talking about the tax man here. A will could help sort out that and stop any family feuds developing after you're gone. So why have so few of us in the UK actually written one, including up until very recently our very own Simon Lambert? 54% of parents with children under 18 don't have a will. But before we hear Simon's excuses, firstly, a very warm welcome to you both. Lee, what exactly is a will? What does it do? Is it watertight? Is it the absolute final word on the matter?
In a nutshell, it should be. If it's written properly and it's done correctly, then it should be the final say on a matter. In real simple terms, it's just a legal document. It's usually drawn up by solicitors, but you might go down the DIY route and write one yourself, or you can use even websites these days that have these will writing services. It just gives you the sort of peace of mind of knowing that things like your property, your investments, your savings, your personal possessions are going to the people that you want them to go to. And also, we've had many cases, Georgie, over the years, This Is Money, where even had power of attorney. You know, it's very difficult if you've not set out a will and let people know who's got the power of attorney. And it can be a real headache for those that you leave behind. So it's a bit of a morbid subject. You know, no one really wants to think about death or think about dying. And I think that's why it actually puts a lot of people off. They think it's almost like a final, isn't it? It's almost like saying, well, you know, I'm going to die one day. It's a subject people don't really want to talk about. But I think it's massively important. And I think this month, actually, there's been the Free Wills Month, which I think is a really good initiative where you can go and get a will written up. I think something needs to change. We need to get more people to write wills. And Simon's article this week will explain why and how.
Simon, yes, indeed. But I want to know, what took you so long? Because regular listeners to the podcast will know that this is something that I've been nudging you in a direction. You've got little children, so why did you not?
That 54% of people with children under the age of 18 who don't have a will, that's a bit silly, really, because if you do die, then someone will need to look after your children. And unfortunately, if you and your partner die at the same time, then neither of you are going to be able to do it anymore. So even at the most basic level, your will does express your wishes as to who you would like to be the guardian. But I think I'd filed it on a pile that Lee laughed when he read this. The pile marked, definitely need to do it, but haven't got the time right now to organise it and then actually see the whole thing through. You might shorten that name to inertia. But it's one of those things where you think, oh, I really need to do that. Oh, and then I'm going to have to organise it. Oh, and then I'm actually going to have to do it. Oh, this is too much trouble.
But you make it sound like it's a really big deal. Was it?
No, actually it wasn't. It was really quite simple. So I spoke to a solicitor, Nicola Waldman, and she is a partner at a law firm called Hodge, Jones and Allen. We arranged a time to go meet her, me and my wife. The meeting lasted less than an hour. She talked us through the basics. She sent us some information beforehand so that we could have thought of some of those basics. We asked her a few questions. She raised a few things that we'd probably need to think about, things that you wouldn't have necessarily thought about yourself. We had a few emails backwards and forwards where there was a few questions we were asking about. Things to do with what do we do if both of us die and the money goes to our children, but they are still at a young age. And then she drew up the will and we looked at it and we decided that we liked it, which is lucky because neither of us had a will. Any other options waiting in the bag. And we signed it and our will was then done.
So from start to finish, how long?
Oh, from start to finish.
And not the procrastination at the start.
No. Basically, we spent less than an hour meeting Nicola. We had a few emails backwards and forwards, a couple of discussions about it. It was all sorted in a few weeks.
Lee, how much does it cost, by the way?
Well, I looked on the money advice service earlier. For a couple, it said it cost about £300.
Okay.
And then for an individual, it should be about £100 to £200. That's using a solicitor.
Oh, that's not too bad.
That's not too bad. No, for such an important document, yeah. I think, you know, you want it done properly. So to get things done properly, you usually pay a fairly good price for it. And as Simon says, it took about an hour. So that's how much, it's probably how much the solicitor charged for an hour's worth of work, I suppose.
Do you think a lot of this is perhaps a lack of understanding and knowledge about bills? One is how much it's going to cost, because actually I thought it'd be a lot more expensive, and also an understanding of what it does. So perhaps people will not know that it offers provision should something happen to you as to what happens to your children, for example.
Yeah, I think people think that it's very simple. If they die, their money will just automatically go to their loved ones. But if you die intestate, so that is without a will, then you basically relinquish control over what happens to your home, your money, your other possessions. It then follows a set of rules on what happens. And if you're married, the first £250,000 of assets goes to the surviving husband or wife, and then the remainder of the estate is split. Half of this goes to the surviving partner, and the other half is divided equally between the surviving children, or passed on to grandkids if they're dead. If you're not married, then the surviving partner has no automatic right to inherit. Okay, so this is, again, this common law spouse misconception that people think about.
Yeah, let's bust this now.
This thing does not exist. You cannot rely on this. And the estate is divided equally between children or their descendants. If there's no children, the estate could go to surviving parents, brothers, sisters, or other relatives. And if there's no one to give it to that goes down the decision tree of who it goes to, the estate goes to the Crown. And we all know that the Crown has got enough money and doesn't need yours. So that's why you need it. What do you put in it? Well, it says who you are, what you're leaving, who you're leaving it to. You name your executors. Those are the people who you want to be responsible for carrying out your wishes and doing the process of probate, where they collect all of your assets and then divvy them up and hand them out. And if you've got children, you name any guardians. So those are the basics. But then there's some more things that you need to think about. So it's a good time to work out what you've got. Now, you don't need an exact list to the penny of what you're worth, but it's very good to have a ballpark figure. Mm-hmm. So that's your house, if you've got one, minus the mortgage, any savings, any investment accounts or products. Also think about, do you have a pension and do you have life insurance? So a pension sits outside of your estate and you can pass that on, relatively tax friendly nowadays. Life insurance, if you do have it, you need to make sure that it is written in trust. And if your life insurance is written in trust, it sits outside of your estate. Don't ask why, weird arcane reasons. But not only is it not counted for inheritance tax purposes, but it also pays out immediately. And you don't have to wait to do probate. So do those things. Mm-hmm. And the reason why you need to know how much you've got is then you know roughly what you're talking about, and also whether you're going to start to come into problems with inheritance tax. Because if you are the kind of person whose estate is going to be big enough to be hit by inheritance tax, then you might want to do things slightly differently in terms of how you leave the money to people.
Listen to last week's podcast and read the accompanying article on that. Lee, I have to ask, and I don't want to go too much into your personal life here, but you have effectively a common law wife. You've got a home. Mm-hmm. Have you written a will?
No.
Right. All right, then.
It is something on my to-do list, but I fear that I might put it in the same pile as Simon did. I think it does change your outlook on life as well when you have children. That is a really massive, important reason why it probably triggers a lot of people into getting a will. So perhaps when their time comes.
All right, then. Say no more, Lee. Say no more.
Going back to that, yeah, it is important once you have kids. And it can be important when you co-own a property. But you might find that there's a situation where people who've bought a property before they're married own it as tenants in common. So it says exactly how much each person owns of that property. But going back to some of the stuff I was saying about inheritance tax, the reason why that can affect who you're going to leave the money to is everyone has a £325,000 inheritance tax-free allowance. There's an extra £100,000 that you now get, building up to £150,000 eventually each for passing on your own home. If you are nowhere near the inheritance tax threshold, then effectively you can leave, you know, your house to your surviving wife or husband, and then you can leave some money to your kids, because you're not going to end up paying 40% tax on that. If you are near the inheritance tax threshold or over it, everything you leave to your wife or husband is free of inheritance tax. But if you start leaving it to the kids, it starts eating into your inheritance tax allowance. So it can be better to pass everything to your wife or husband, and then they start to try and gift it to the kids. And so what you also need to think about here is legacies. Do you want to leave people any individual things? It might be money. It might be that classic car that you want to leave to your motoring mad niece. It might be the jewellery you want to leave to your daughter or your son, or some money you want to leave to your grandchildren. Perhaps you want to leave them £5,000 each. Also, there's some other more complicated stuff, which is where it starts to get difficult to think about, particularly if you are a parent. And that is, what if you both die? You know, the car crash scenario. You've got to think about who's going to look after your kids, but how are they going to be provided for? So if they're under 18, you put the money into this thing called put it in trust, and you have trustees who look after it and provide for the children. They can draw on that money to provide for the children. But then do you just give them the money at 18? The problem is, you might potentially be worth hundreds of thousands of pounds if you've owned a home for some time. Do you want to give an 18-year-old hundreds of thousands of pounds worth of assets? And I wouldn't actually want to put that responsibility on either of my daughters if they were 18. So how do you kind of stop them getting the money? The easiest way and the most common way is to put it in trust until they're 25. And then the trustees can draw on that money. They can give them money if they want to help funding university. Maybe they want to get a car. They want to get help buying a house. But the kids can't get their hands on the money and do whatever they want with it until they're 25. But there are some tax implications there. And that's why it's important to talk to someone who knows what they're doing, like a solicitor or an expert, because they can explain those tax experts. And then the other thing is the even more uncomfortable one, the worst case scenario. The disaster strikes. You're all wiped out. You, your spouse, and the kids kind of thing.
Goodness me.
What do you do with the money then? Who does it get passed to? You don't want to think about that, but you actually do need to think about that and then put it in your will. And then finally, the mistake that a lot of people make is they do all of this and they get sent their will and then they don't sign it. And they don't, or not only do they not sign it, well, they sign it and they don't get it witnessed properly. And the rules on who witnesses your will are not particularly complicated, but it needs to be someone who doesn't stand to benefit from the will.
Mm-hmm.
And if they do stand to benefit from the will and they sign it, then it doesn't invalidate the will, but it does invalidate any benefit that they may derive from the will. So I could have got my sister to sign it. I'm not leaving my sister anything directly in the will, but if I get my sister to sign it and, you know, the worst case scenario happens or something like that and she ends up getting some of the money, it invalidates her from it. And then you need to tell people where it is, and ideally when they've forgotten where it is, you need to tell them which solicitor you wrote it with, because it is a very common scenario, and this mm-hmm. is particularly with older people,
yeah.
where the person dies, they've written a will, but nobody knows where it is. Now, this happened with my grandmother. Now, we knew she'd written a will, but we didn't know where it was, and it took us a while to find it, and she'd named my dad as the executor. But unfortunately, my dad just died before my grandmother. I don't think my grandmother ever thought my dad would die before her. Mm, I'm not sure whether my dad would have actually remembered where the will was or what solicitor she'd done it with. We thought we were going to have to ring round the solicitors in the town where she lived to try and find out which one had done her will. But think about how many times this must happen, that people don't find the will.
But that's a surprise. I would have thought there'd be some sort of central data, but there's nothing like that.
No, there isn't. So do try and introduce a level of organisation that, if you're like me, you would find deeply uncomfortable into your life, and at least write down somewhere all the different accounts that you've got.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, your loved ones, when you die, might not know about that investment account. They might not know about this. And this is even more important now that we don't get stuff through the post. At least they would have eventually got something through the post that went, oh, they had a Hargreaves Lansdown account. If you don't get anything through the post, then you wouldn't know. And finally, can you write a will yourself on a piece of paper?
Or a text message, as in Australia.
Yeah. Do you want to know the answer?
Go for it.
So, yes, if you write a will yourself on a piece of paper, it can be valid, provided it is signed and witnessed correctly. And that's the important bit. So my wife, many years ago, wrote on a piece of paper her will. And she wrote, I basically leave all of this to, you know, I think it was to me. And then her sister signed it and someone else signed it. Now, her will on that piece of paper would have been valid. However, her sister, if I hadn't have been there, would have been the person who would have potentially benefited from it. And so actually then it would have invalidated her sister from benefiting from it. So there you
close.
Go.
Yet so
look,
go to
thisismoney.co.uk. Go to our This Is How Money Works section if you want to read the full article. I hope it is helpful for people. It certainly set quite a few things straight in my mind and made me realise I really should have done this much, much sooner.
But you've done it now, and that's all that counts. Lee, you're next, son. All right, so banks are increasingly being accused of not doing enough to help victims of fraud. But it now transpires they're sitting on a secret £130 million cash pile that could be used to refund victims. Now, this money's been frozen in accounts opened by criminals who run these convincing scams to dupe customers out of their life savings. Banks say that they've been unable to return that cash to their rightful owners because of onerous rules. So, thankfully, we've got Lee the Scam Man Boyce here to tell us a little bit more about this story. Secret £130 million cash pile. What's this about?
Yeah, this is an investigation by our sister title, Money Mail. And actually, I've always wondered where the money goes that gets frozen in these accounts and can't really be like moved around because of these sort of laws that exist around data protection and not being able to sort of put money from one account into a different account that it didn't originate from and all of that sort of thing. So this is a conservative estimate, by the way, £130 million. So there might be more in this fund, given how much bank fraud has exploded in the last couple of years.
Yeah, I thought it was quite low.
I wouldn't be surprised. But first of all, I'm gonna say banks, on the whole, are good in these fraud situations. I know we do highlight some of these cases where, unfortunately, people haven't got their money back, but they don't want people to fall victims of fraud. I think that's the important thing to remember. You know, it's costing them money. They don't want to see people go out of pocket, and they don't want the bad publicity that comes with it. So in a lot of cases, money is refunded. But in some, they will say that a customer's been negligent, so might have handed over some details over the phone, and for that reason, they've been defrauded. Now, in that case, they have to then go through the ombudsman, and sometimes they end up not getting the money back, and that could be life savings, right? So what they're saying here, Money Mail saying, well, if that's the case in some of this, why can't this fund be used to compensate those that have been refused a refund by the bank? It could be a central pool of money. That makes sense, doesn't it? It's almost like you go logically, yeah, why wouldn't we just do that? What's that money doing? It's just sitting around in fraudulent bank accounts from a number of banks. They could club together, almost like a pool of money to compensate people. Now, what they've discovered is that it's down to some rules. At the moment, banks are saying they couldn't possibly do this until the government changes the law. They'd have to amend an Act of Parliament which covers money laundering, and our money laundering laws, especially in the last 5 years, have become extremely tight. It would take quite a bit of a nudge for this amendment to be changed and this pool of money to be used, but it's not beyond the realms of possibility that it could happen.
Now, you highlighted, though, a case of poor Linda, didn't you? She lost almost £8,000 of her saving to fraudsters posing as BT workers. Now, Lloyds won't give her the money back. Mm-hmm. And rightly what you said, I've been defrauded in the past and I've had great service from my bank, so no problems here, and there are just individual cases, hopefully. Mm-hmm. But Linda will have to think now, she says, about putting back her retirement. And what you're saying is this exactly the type of scenario where freeing up some money would really help people like this.
Exactly. So she lost £8,000. So someone phoned up. We've seen this scam a lot. Someone phones up, pretending to be from a big brand like BT. BT seems to be quite a popular one to mimic, I suppose, because it's got such a big customer base. And people do have problems with BT, and BT genuine staff members will call up and try and diagnose problems. So this is what happened with Linda. She had a problem with her mobile phone that she'd logged. She kept on having adverts popping up on her screen of her mobile. She's a BT mobile customer. And then someone phoned up, magically knew that she was having problems with the phone. So we don't know how that fraudster knew at the other end that she was having problems. It might have been that they just socially engineered her on the phone saying, oh, we hear you're having problems. And she might have then revealed. We don't know the full ins and outs of that. But for whatever reason, she believed that it was genuinely BT phoning her. She let the person at the end of the phone gave a few details to sort of run some diagnostics on the phone, all that sort of thing. A few hours later, £8,000 had been taken from her account, and Lloyds are basically saying that you were negligent, so we're not going to refund. And that is something that we're seeing more and more of. You know, banks tend to refund in the majority of cases if it's something like your card's been cloned in a cash machine, because you've not done anything wrong. You've used a cash machine and it's been cloned for, you know, whatever reason. There's nothing you could have done about it. But what they're saying is, in cases like this, you've handed out details over the phone. But what we've argued for years and this type of thing, does it pass the reasonable person test? Would someone picking up that phone genuinely think that's from BT? And I think in this case, yeah, you know, she thought it was from BT. It's not like she's purposely gone to lose her money. She doesn't want to lose £8,000. If the banks are going to put up and say, well, actually, you'd be negligent, well, why don't we use this pool of £130 million so someone hasn't lost their life savings, you know, learnt a massive lesson. And all we can keep doing, financial journalists, is keep hammering home all of these frauds and what's happening and get the public as aware as possible of just to treat everything with utmost caution.
Great advice there, Lee. I do want to just stick, though, with BT. Completely different slant, though, because that was fraudsters posing as BT workers. But the real BT, well, they've been a bit of hot water, haven't they, lately? The company's been ordered to cut landline bills by £84 a year for 1 million of their customers, who Ofcom say have been trapped in rip-off deals. And Kel Surprise, who's the hardest hit? Well, it is, of course, older customers. They have around 43% of customers with a standalone landline contract are 75 or over. Just a quick one about this, Lee. What's been going on here?
Well, I was hammering this home for a couple of years ago about how line rental just keeps nudging up. All, you know, one goes, one of the big boys goes, and they all start nudging up line rental. What is it actually going towards? Why? What justifies these price hikes? Keep saying it's to invest it into infrastructure, but it doesn't appear to me that people are getting any better sort of service or better landline or better broadband. And of course, the people that get hit the most in this are the elderly. So as you rightly point out, 2/3 of BT customers who only have a landline are over 65. So this is who we're talking about in this story. This is who Ofcom have told BT, you need to stop ripping these people off. So they're going to see their line rental fall from £18.99 a month, which is the standard at the moment, it's going to go down to £11.99 a month, which is a way better deal. And of course, these customers are ones that don't have broadband, basically. They, you know, they're just landline-only customers. So they probably use their landline way more than people that have broadband landline. I've got broadband landline. I've never used my home phone. Yeah. I bet there's lots of people in the same scenario. But older people, they tend to use their home phone. So it's going to be 1 million people that are going to save on this. And do you know what? I'm going to stand up and say, finally, Ofcom, I feel like are getting some teeth and doing something, and they should do this more. They should start saying, you know, what is this whole monopoly over line rental all about? It's something I've been asking for a long time. Hopefully, we're going to start seeing some more movement.
As Lee said, we've talked about this before, and to look at it from the other perspective, from the shareholders' perspective in these companies, some time ago, a fund manager was talking about one of the broadband and telephone companies, and saying that they were a great investment. And one of the reasons why they said that they were a great investment was because of the way they were able to ratchet up landline charges and how much they were able to pull in from this. The excuse that they give, as Lee said, is investing in the infrastructure. But often the excuse they give is to do with the cost of investing in the broadband infrastructure. Well, hang on a minute. What's my broadband bit of the bill for then? Why am I paying for broadband as well? You know, these are people who don't even have the internet. They don't have broadband. They're less likely to use a mobile phone. And essentially, this is just a cash cow.
Yeah. Why should their bills be used to fund something that they aren't going to benefit from either?
It's because there's a captive audience and it's a cash cow. And there is no way that line rental charges should have risen by as much as they have done over the last 5 to 10 years. I can't see any improvement that has been made to people's landlines over that period of time. So all I can see is that this is basically a cash cow. And it's good that it's stopping.
I had to give an interview yesterday over a landline. They wanted a landline and I was running around the flat trying to search if I had one. I genuinely didn't know if I had one. I don't, by the way.
We went to use ours a while back and discovered that the phone that normally sits in its little hands-free cradle had been replaced by a small cuddly toy. and it could have been there for months. And then we had to try and work out where on earth my daughter, who had replaced it with the cuddly toy, had put the phone.
It's in the cupboard with the smart meter, yeah?
I had a shot the other day because my mum actually phoned me on the landline. So I do have a phone plugged in. I hadn't heard it ring for probably 18 months and it actually made me jump. I was like, what is that? And I think she's the only person that's got the number. I haven't got a clue what it is.
There's only two people who phone my landline. My wife's mum, who does it after trying to ring one of our mobiles. And then you've got to go, where on earth is the phone? And Leeds University, who every so often try and ring me up to get me to give them some money.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I didn't even go to Leeds. Okay, so this is just before we let this go, only BT customers, they will see their bills reduced. What about the thousands with the standalone contracts with other providers, such as Post Office or Virgin Media?
Well, I don't know. They may be being looked into by Ofcom, but let's think about it. BT are the ones that, you know, especially elderly people trust more. They're more likely to have been with them for decades. So that was the important one to really sort of focus on. Behind the scenes, Ofcom might be having a look into them. Let's hope so.
Yeah, let's hope others will follow suit.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I Premium Bonds. giving you the chance every month to win up to £1 million tax-free.
Coming up...
Buffett will say, far better to pay a fair price for a great business than a great price for a fair business. And I totally subscribe to that idea. So on occasions, I will pay what I describe as a workmanlike price rather than a bargain price if I'm pretty confident about the future of the company.
We bring you the Buffettologist's Guide to Finding Winning Shares. But first, just a quick update, if you would, on the state of the nation. Simon, we got some important economic figures out this week, which, well, I guess could have an impact on whether interest rates go up next week. So what is the picture looking like? Well, ahead of that decision, but also we've got a budget looming, haven't we?
Ah, yes, the budget. the second budget of the year. Looking forward to that one. Although this does mean that we get let off next March. There won't be a budget next March. So,
book your holidays now. This is Money Start.
Yes, indeed, indeed. So what have we got this week, economics-wise? GDP, that beat expectations of a 0.3% increase in the gross domestic product of the nation, everything that we do, basically, by coming in at 0.4%. I mean, that's hardly smashing it. but that is enough.
Yep.
Is enough for people to be saying that it is nailed on that we are getting this interest rate rise next week from 0.25% to 0.5%. But on the coattails of the GDP beat came some pretty desperate figures from the retail sector, which were the worst since March 2009. So basically they're seeing falling sales. We also had some terrible profit figures from Debenhams, down 44%, who also, more importantly probably there, warned of a tough Christmas. So inflation is starting to weigh on people. And I think that what we are about to see over the coming months is going to be a succession of high street clothes retailers telling us about how they were hit by unseasonably warm weather in October, and that's going to have wrecked their sales. Whether that's actually the truth or whether that's papering over the cracks, who knows? So will that rate rise be nailed on next Thursday? We will find out, won't we? We will find out. I don't know. I think they might raise it, but there's also a chance that they'll stick on that side of, ooh, don't want to rock the boat, because there wasn't great construction figures out this week either. So construction's in a bit of a recession too.
All right, then. I do want to ask Lee, before we talk about sort of how we should be preparing ourselves. We saw an increase in the amount of money that people are borrowing on credit cards, up just 8% in 1 year. So if they're not spending it at the shops, is there a correlation between how much perhaps people are spending it on bills? Is that going up, you know, just keeping their heads above water? Or is it spending on experiences? Do we have any sort of data there?
I think it's actually probably, Georgie, a combination of both of those things. It's quite worrying, actually, how that personal debt level keeps ticking higher. We mentioned it in a show a couple of months back, looking at it, it's ticked over the £200 billion mark. That is frightening. But I think things like energy bills are going up, and that might be swaying a little bit of the monthly spend of people. And then people don't like to go without things. You know, I saw some stats out earlier in the year that we're taking more holidays than ever. People were probably just taking a holiday, throwing it on a credit card, worry about it later. I suppose people think at the moment, you know, interest rates and things like that are low compared to previous times, but there's only one way that interest rates can go from here, whether it be next month or whether it be early next year, who knows? But it's worrying. I think people really do need to start thinking about paying down any debt that they have, if they can. But of course, a lot of people, that's why they get into debt in the first place. So
exactly, the interest rate rise is going to impact, you know, borrowers the worst. And when we talk about it going up, it's a smidge, especially if you think about it historically speaking. But that smidge, I think research has worked out, you know, 0.25% could add around £200 a year to the average mortgage. But if you've got your mortgage, you've got a personal loan, you've got credit cards, and we're already seeing, you know, mortgage rates, the best deals go, the best credit card deals go.
Well, exactly. So things are nudging higher. Now, you rightly say that if there's going to be an interest rate rise, it's going to only nudge, you know, back to 0.5%, which is exactly where we were a year ago. You know, it's exactly what we've had for, you know, 10 years or so. So it's not all doom and gloom. It's not to start going, oh my God, everyone's going to really start struggling. And we're just rewinding to where we were a year ago. Now, there was a story we've got up on the website about half of mortgage borrowers never seen a rate rise. That's quite incredible, isn't it? You know, half of mortgage owners, they've never seen a rate rise. I mean, it's absolutely incredible. But I think what it is, you're saying about adding £200 on there, we're seeing that happening in other ways, on other types of bills anyway. I mean, we talk about gas and electric, that's gone up, you know, probably 10% for most people this year. car insurance, I mean, that is going through the roof. The cost of running a car, cost of transport, all of that is going through the roof. But at the same time, wages are just not matching inflation. They're not growing at a level that can sort of cope with this. And I reckon there is a little bit of that at play, and that's why we're getting more credit card debt. And it could get worse as we go into next year.
And now to Buffettology. Simon's been chatting to a Buffettologist who applies the Warren Buffett School of Investing to his UK investment fund.
Most of our companies have very strong balance sheets. Two-thirds of the companies in the portfolio, no gearing or minimal single digits. We look for what I call businesses that are predictable to a higher than normal degree of certainty. And what I mean by that is that we know where those businesses are going to be in 3 years, 5 years, 10 years. We've got a roadmap for them that we can judge them against. And the last thing is management. You know, the number one job of management in my book is rational allocation of capital. And I like businesses that can reinvest retained earnings at high marginal returns to generate organic growth. If they can't, I'm not averse to bolt-on acquisitions where, you know, the classic 2 plus 2 equals more than 4, so new markets, new technologies, new products, or maybe synergy benefits. I hate with a passion mega acquisitions. I am very, very, very wary of those because they usually come to grief. And then the last point would be on the management. If they can't find bolt-ons and they can't invest in their own business to generate future growth and they're producing surplus capital, give it back to me as a special dividend so I can go and allocate that capital.
Well, that was Keith Ashworth Lord there. For the full interview with Simon and Keith on The Investing Show and previous episodes, of course, go to thisismoney.co.uk/money/investing show. But Buffettology, Simon, the floor is yours.
Yes. What on earth is Buffettology? Good question. It's to do with Warren Buffett. You won't be surprised.
I've got that.
Yeah. The clue's in the name. And it's an ology, so Maureen Lipman would like it as well. Basically, it is taking the sort of school of investing thought of Warren Buffett and applying it over here. There was a couple of Buffettology books that were written. They've tried to identify the principles of this. Mm-hmm. Keith Ashworth Lord, he has been an investor for quite some time, was an analyst previously, and he told me that he had, after sort of casting around for many years for the right way to try and find the best companies, he decided that this Buffettology way of thinking was the best. And he ran his own money like this for a while, and then he decided to set up this fund. And he's licensed the name to run the fund over here. It picks, it's very, quite a tight portfolio, so only 30 different shares in it. Mm-hmm. And what he looks for are companies that benefit from some form of moat. So what they can do is they can keep growing profits at a level that other people can't eat into them. Now, in theory, a company that makes excess profits, if it puts money into its business, and by putting money into its business, it can then profit from it and continues to make good profits year in, year out, should have those eaten into, because rivals will go, oh, look, they're making money over there, and they'll nip in and nab some of it. But you find businesses that manage to do this for years and years and years. And the reason is because they've got some kind of special sauce on what they do and why they can do that. So he tries to identify those companies. There's various screening methods that he uses. Then he looks into the company. He wants good management teams. And he says that there aren't that many great companies around. And when you find them, you should invest into them heavily. So it's a relatively tight portfolio, 30 different companies, but it's done super well. So it's up 148% over the past 5 years, which is pretty much double what the UK all companies sector has done. And out of those 5 years, it's beaten the market in all but one. And actually, he said that he has been investing using this strategy for longer than he's been running the fund, and going back over time, you know, there are years when it will underperform, but actually in most of the years it did outperform, and cumulatively that outperformance adds up to a lot. And I think what's interesting here is one of the charges levied at many fund managers is that effectively you might as well just buy an index tracker fund, because then what you're doing is removing the risk of picking a manager who actually doesn't turn out to be very good. And lots of managers just end up being this thing called closet trackers, where they kind of just hug the index anyway. You look at their portfolios, and they look suspiciously like the stock market index, and all you're doing is paying them more money for the same kind of returns you get from the stock market. Now, in this case with Keith's fund, it is demonstrably clear that this is not an index tracker. It performs very differently to the stock market. And if you think that that kind of investing style is good and could pay off, which you might, you know, just because he's done well for 5 years doesn't mean that that's true. You know, you need to look further into it than that. But if you think that that's the kind of thing that could pay off, then this does represent a proper alternative to using a tracker fund. You'll pay more money for it, but the returns have been better. Anyway, I thought he was a really interesting guy to speak to. And yeah, if you're interested in investing, then do go and watch the video, because I really enjoyed doing this interview.
Good. And you can tell in the interview. But just before we move on, what are the things that you should be thinking about? You said if you wanted to go into investing like this, how can you weigh up what you're after, what you want, what are your risks?
Okay, so firstly, it's very different picking one individual fund that you think has a good idea or is going to do well to building an investment portfolio. When you're building an investment portfolio, what you need to think about is your appetite for risk, the potential losses that you could make versus the potential rewards that you could gain. And if you were to just take all of your money and put it into one fund like this, you would be taking a very high risk, because this approach has worked very well for the last 5 years. What if it doesn't work very well for the next 5 years? Things change in the markets. Different approaches work at different times, depending on what's going on in the world. It might be that all of the gains from the kind of companies that Keith invests in have been had, and actually they're going to have a dud next 5 years. So if you invest all of your money in them, that's not going to be a good move. And you also need to be looking at what you're invested in your portfolio versus the overall makeup of the global stock market, for example. So if you're only talking about shares, so the global stock market is made up by about 50 or 60% US stocks and then divided down. So if you invested only in UK companies, then you're massively what they call overweight on the UK, because 50 to 60% of the global stock market is made up of the US. So you need to be thinking about how you position yourself versus the wider market. Otherwise, you run the risk of massively outperforming it. And you also need to be thinking about how you have an element of safety in your portfolio. If you're young and you're investing and your investing time horizon is forever, then you could potentially invest 100% in shares. If not, you might want to think about having some cash, having some bonds in there, because when the markets fall, then you won't get sideswiped quite as badly.
Fantastic. And also just a reminder that, and I can't remember when it was about 6 months ago, you did a really, really comprehensive, brilliant, easy to access guide on investing. Where can we go for that?
thisismoney.co.uk/investing-guide. And that's our guide, how to be a successful investor. It's short enough to be sat, read, sitting down in one reading, or you can refer back to it while you're investing.
It's on my coffee table. Yeah, well thumbed through. I kid you not, it's not. It's because I haven't tidied up in a long time. But anyway, finally, there comes a time when the family has to say goodbye to a well-loved car. But well, it seems there are some brands that we find easier to say adieu to than others. And there's never been an easier time to trade in your old bangers. So no fewer than 24 car brands have offered scrappage schemes since the beginning of the year. So what are those cars, according to Auto Trader, that we are most likely to be happy to get rid of? Lee, before I start, what's the scrappage scheme stuff?
The scrappage scheme stuff I just find absolutely fascinating. You know, they're billing it as a kind of get rid of your dirty car and you can put it towards a new one. All it is that these manufacturers are doing is just trying to prop up their sales after months of falling sales. You know, people haven't got appetites for buying as many new cars as what they did last year. So I find it one of those things that it's just kind of like, I don't know, one did it, but I think Vauxhall was the first in May. And then all of the others sort of followed suit. It's just a ploy to get you to buy a new car. They don't care if you're getting rid of whatever. They just want you to sell these new cars. They're just going to sit on the forecourt. Anyway, this is...
But it's interesting you say that, Lee, because actually we got some car figures out.
Exactly, that's what I'm
recently,
saying.
Yeah.
You know, the manufacturers have gone through a real boom period in the last couple of years of new car sales in Britain. Now, appetite shrunk. You know, it was going to shrink at some point. The sales figures were absolutely astronomical. A lot of these cars were just being registered and left on the forecourts. And now they're desperate to get rid of them. I mean, I don't think there's actually probably been a better time to haggle for a new car. I really don't. Anyway, this story, 10 cars that owners want to scrap and replace. Basically, from Auto Trader, it's launched a tool. And he launched this tool last week and something like 20 or 1,000 people have used it. You type in your details and it shows you your car, what you can get from a scrappage deal from the manufacturer of your car. So you could then see what models are out there to then say, well, actually, yeah, I might pay that to get that car. The top three actually are three of the biggest selling cars in Britain, which is no real surprise really, because it's what most people have. But number one is actually the VW Golf. Interesting little tidbit of information from this tool that Auto Trader have given to us. 30% of all cars that ran through the tool were VWs. And of course, they were the ones that really started this emissions cheating backlash. Which feels like a real long time ago, Georgia, now, doesn't it? It's incredible to think how fast the time goes.
Doesn't
but,
it, just?
You know, they were found to have been duffing up the figures people might look at to see how economical a car is and how much pollutants that they put out there. So people were a little bit annoyed, obviously, with Volkswagen with that. And it looks like through this tool that people are interested in getting rid of that. The Polo was number 7. So people look like they might want to get rid of the Volkswagens. But of course, if you're looking at this tool, the likelihood is you're going to scrap it and get another Volkswagen. So who knows? But yeah, the top five, I mean, we had Golf, Focus, Astra. We've also got the Fiesta and Corsa. Now, the reason that they're going to be in there is just that that's what most people have. But if you are in the hunt for a new car, it's well worth seeing what you can get these scrappage scheme discounts. But don't undersell yourself. Have a look how much you could sell it for privately. You know, do all the checks that you would usually do on a new car. You know, really hammer down some discounts on these forecourts. Well, you know, these people have got targets to meet, and I'm going to be shocked if they're meeting these targets.
Simon Lee's not a big fan. Is there ever a benefit to these scrappage schemes?
If you do want to buy a new car and the manufacturer that you want to buy the new car from is offering, you know, £2,000 or £3,000 off with scrappage, and your car is only worth about £800 or a grand, then yes, of course it is, because you're making money. Although you've got to bear in mind that don't tell the dealer about the scrappage until you've negotiated on the price and then tell them about it, because otherwise they won't give you as big a discount. But what this does illustrate is basically people are phenomenally lazy about selling second-hand cars nowadays. The huge rise of services like We Buy Any Car, which offer you much less than your car is worth. I have sold a number of second-hand cars, and I have had We Buy Any Car valuations, and I sold both of those for at least £1,000 more than We Buy Any Car was offering me. Just illustrates this. And also the fact that the Golf is top of this pile, because Golfs, if you know anything about cars, you'll know are phenomenally easy cars to sell. Mm-hmm. I sold my mate's Golf for him because he was moving over to Italy, and I put it up and I sold it within 2 days to someone who drove down from Birmingham to buy it and paid me exactly how much money I was asking for it, which was a fair price, but not a ridiculous price. But they're very easy cars to sell, Golfs, and this just illustrates how people just will not seem to do the thing that people used to do, which is put your second-hand car up, someone comes around and sees it, and you sell it. And they think they can't be bothered, or it's too much hassle, or all those other things, or they worry about who's going to come around. But they are often costing themselves, you know, £500 to £1,000 in the process. So if you do have a second-hand car, I beg you, don't hand £1,000 to a car dealer or a service like We Buy Any Car. Just sell it yourself. Especially if it's a Golf, because that's really easy.
Okay, then, from the unloved to the unreliable, what car? Have a new owner satisfaction report out, and it is not looking good for British cars, Simon.
Well, I mean, not all British cars, but you have two top 10 lists here. You have the top 10 most reliable cars in each category, and you have the top 10 least reliable cars for different categories. And in the most reliable cars, the Honda Jazz, the Toyota Aygo, the Lexus CT200H and the Audi A3 scored astonishing 100% reliability scores.
Wow.
Unfortunately, in the least reliable cars in their respective categories, Britain's Range Rover Sport and Jaguar XE, both the diesel versions of those cars, I should say, came bottom of the pile, and also the British-built Nissan Qashqai petrol that came bottom of its category as well, which was unfortunate. So,
what were they looking at there, Lee? Any surprises for you?
To be honest, they do this list on a yearly basis, and it does tend to stay the same sort of cars. But what they look at is they sort of quiz a real large range of motorists that, you know, own these cars, and they look at cars that are under 3 years old. You know, you only have to MOT a car for the first time when it's 3 years old. And so they look at cars that are under 3 years old, and you wouldn't expect to have any kind of fault in the first 3 years of car ownership, really. You know, brand new, unless you're driving it absolutely loads, it shouldn't really have any problems. But they look at a number of things that can go wrong with it, some of these cars. And, you know, it's well worth pointing out in this now as well, is that cars are getting more expensive to repair because of the technology that can be involved in some of these motors. So it's a real good gauge, actually, I think, of looking, you know, from people that actually own these cars and can actually tell you what goes wrong with them. So you can get you establish what the most common faults are on certain cars. Also in this list are just the car brands, you know, how reliable the car brands are. So top of the pile was Lexus, which has got a 92.1% reliability score. Bottom is Jeep, 42.1%. It's the only one there that more than half of cars that are Jeeps develop some sort of problem within the first 3 years, which is a little bit of a worry, isn't it? I mean, that's not looking good for Jeeps. So I do think it's a really worthwhile thing. Looking at, there's 14 categories, you know, small things like the battery, but large things like the brakes, the engine, the exhaust. 14,000 car owners take part in it. So it's a quite a comprehensive study of the motoring market.
So do take a look at that. But before I let you go, lads, just indulge me. One, hopefully final time. Will interest rates go up next week? Last chance. Come on, play the game.
I'm going to stick by my guns where I said that I thought that interest rates could rise this year, and I am going to say yes.
Lee?
No, it was 7-2 last month. It's going to be a no again. It's not till next year.
I'm going to say no. Editor Simon Lambert, Consumer Affairs Editor Lee Boyce, seems up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes, tell your friends and family, and join in the conversation.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I Premium Bonds, making saving that little bit more exciting.